Welcome to the Classic Holdup Podcast, where we analyze media from the past. Each episode features a different host that brings a fresh take on a film, TV show, video game, or music album of their choice. What can we discover? Do old favorites have a shelf life? Will the classics hold up?
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Classic Holdup. My name is Declan Keating, and I'll be your host this evening. So I grew up in Chicago, Illinois, around early 2000s. I was born in 2001, and me and my parents and my bird, Biggie, or Mr. Biggs, lived on the east side of Chicago, if you could call it that. There isn't really an east side because of Lake Michigan, but we lived, about as close to that as you could be. We were by this totem pole and bird sanctuary by Maravitz Golf Course. And then when I was in middle school, we ended up moving a bit north to Andersonville, which is a really cute little neighborhood. I love Chicago so much. It's one of my favorite cities in the world, if not my favorite. And it's just, I mean, it's home, but it's also just an amazing place. I mean, if you haven't been there, you should definitely go check it out. There's so many opportunities, like crazy, unique live art performances or music or all the amazing food, and the list could kind of go on. The architecture is really cool downtown, let alone just like the culture of the city is awesome. But yeah, so today we are going to be talking about King Crimson and their debut album, In the Court of the Crimson King, subtitled An Observation by King Crimson. This is not only the debut record by the English progressive rock band King Crimson, it is also the album that skyrocketed this band into the stratosphere, for lack of a better word, and kind of set them aside from everything else that had ever been done before in that realm of music. The album was released on October 10th, 1969, on Island Records, which is a multinational record label owned by Universal Music Group. Given the album's notoriety amongst musicians and fans of the progressive rock genre, it's pretty unbelievable that this was one of the earliest albums in the genre to date. In the Court of the Crimson King has been considered by many critics nowadays to be one of the greatest progressive rock albums of all time. It reached number 5 on the UK albums chart and number 28 on the US Billboard 200, where it was certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America. This behemoth of an album has a runtime of about 45 minutes, and the track list on it is 21st Century Schizoid Man, including Mirrors, I Talk to the Wind, Epitaph, including March for No Reason and Tomorrow, Moonchild, including The Dream and The Illusion, and The Court of the Crimson King, including The Return of the Fire Witch and The Dance of the Puppets. Now, there's a remastered version that has come out recently, and there's actually been a number of remasters, but there are some unreleased tracks on those, but we're not going to focus on that today. We're going to be trying to focus on the initial debut version, which has the 5-song track list on it. So before we dive in here, I'll give a little bit of a background on my experience with this album. When I was in high school, I really started getting into prog rock more because I was exposed to this jazz funk fusion genre, specifically like the Miles Davis era fusion stuff and like Herbie Hancock and the Headhunters and like Snarky Puppy and stuff like that, as well as some Afrobeat, which is very different from prog rock, but all of these genres have very complicated elements to them, and so I think that's probably what sent me down that path. But it's interesting that I chose this album, I think, because my initial reaction to it was not the best, but I have come back to it over the years and it's grown on me a lot. But that being said, my initial exposure to Crimson was not this era of the band. For those who don't know the band, they have spanned multiple generations almost, and the only remaining member is Robert Fripp, who is the guitarist, and so he has kind of rebuilt the band a number of times over the years, and so the version of it that I am most familiar with is the 80s Crimson version, or the 80s Crimson band, and it is, let me say, just highly different, very, very different. But yeah, it has grown on me a lot now that I've dove into the older stuff, and I'm excited to talk about it. So we'll be right back. Well, I am here with Akul and Gampali, and we are going to be talking about King Crimson. So why don't we start with like a little bit of musical background for you? Like, where did you start playing and like how old were you?
Sure, absolutely. So like most musicians, I feel like, at least, you know, who grew up in like a suburban area, my parents stuck me into piano lessons. I was 2 or 3 years old, probably more like 3 years old. And I did that for 8 years. And
then wow.
I decided that I hated it, and the day I quit piano lessons was the day I fell in love with music, which is the case for a lot of musicians whose parents kind of throw them into an instrument. And I took this background that I had, you know, theory background that I had with piano, and I just started kind of snowballing into a bunch of different instruments. So I went to drums next, I became a percussionist, and then just spiraled to a bunch of string instruments, guitar, bass, ukulele, mandolin, sitar, and we kind of just kept going, and now I'm at 13 instruments.
Wow, dude. Oh, my God.
And what that means is I'm a very mediocre musician at all of the instruments. I've not mastered any. I'm still
very
in the process
humble.
Of doing that. But, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know if you're familiar with the YouTuber Rob Scallon, who's just kind of this wacky figure who just tries to pick up any instrument he finds.
Wow, that's really cool. No, I haven't heard about that.
He's a really cool, he has some pretty cool content, and he's probably got hundreds and hundreds of instruments from a bunch of different cultures, and I'm just kind of trying to be like that.
That's amazing, just, yeah. You know. All right, so where was the first time, or I mean, when was the first time that you heard this album?
Yeah, so, I mean, I feel like most people go through their prog rock phase in high school. I was definitely probably a freshman or a sophomore in high school, and I kicked hard into prog rock, like entry-level, like late 60s, early 70s prog rock, and my friends who I was in a band with, or one of the bands I was in at the time, was like, hey, you gotta check out King Crimson. And I'd seen the album art, the very famous album art.
Oh, of course.
You've seen it everywhere, on every shirt, and every poster, and I'm like, oh, I need to check this out, and I gave it a pretty deep dive. Really never left the first album. I never found a reason to, I guess, back then, because I had an hour plus worth of listening in like four or five tracks. And that definitely set me off on early prog.
That's very interesting to me, because I feel like when I was in high school, when I first got into Crimson, my initial reception of this album was not particularly the best. I mean, it's not like I disliked it or anything. It was just, the sound of it was very odd to me. Like, I started out with them, like, I'm a big vinyl collector, so I bought In the Wake of Poseidon, which is not, I believe it's, yeah, it's the album directly after this, and a lot of people in the community say that it's kind of like In the Court of the Crimson King 2. And I can't really
say that they're wrong because it is very similar in terms of like it's got that Renaissance feel to it. The a lot of the themes that you get in that are there, but they're not really as heavy, I guess. Like if you look at like the lyrics of a lot of the stuff in the court, a lot of it is relating to I guess like things that are just like happening in the world at the time. Like I believe the Schizoid Man was referring to the Vietnam War and like a lot of people like developing this kind of personality disorder as a result of like all the like horrific events that are happening in the world at the time. And then I know Epitaph was also commenting on the Cold War. And so there, it's a lot of these like heavy stuff that's going on. And then like you get to In the Wake of Poseidon and there's like a theme at the start. Then there's quite literally a blues song, but it's like it's King Crimson. So it's like it doesn't really sound like blues, but right. It's blues.
Right. Rock blues.
Yeah. And then it goes to Cadence and Cascade, which is very similar to I Talk to the Wind. And, like, I don't know, a lot of the stuff in this is just very goofy. Like, it's very, like, I don't know, like, when I think of Prague, I think of, like, silly ideas, like, generally not heavy themes. And so that's why, to me, Court really stands out, because they actually do, like, touch on, like, some, like, real stuff that's happening.
It's interesting you say that, because when I think about Prague, if we're taking a step back and looking at Prague as a genre, I see the genre as, like, generally touching on dark subjects. But I think you're right, because you look at Moonchild, which is just this wacky instrumental
jump. Yeah.
And it's like fun and, like, silly. So I guess, like, do you view Prague as a whole as, like, a generally happy genre or a silly genre?
Yes.
Interesting.
I listened to it again. I listened to it in the court last night again. And it's a hilarious album at times. Like Moonchild in particular, it's so funny. It just makes me laugh so much.
I had that
much.
Playing on the drive here, and I was just like, I could hear and like visualize the characters, if you can call them instruments. I'm considering the instruments characters. I should take a step back. Yeah, no, I could hear the conversations and just like the silliness and the banter happening. Like, I don't know how you visualize that song, but I can see almost a musical taking place in my head.
It's sort of. It certainly is kind of like almost a conversation that they are having. Yeah. Like it, they. I mean, the first part of this is like kind of that. It goes with the lyrics, and then it disperses into that kind of
you have the improv phone filtered,
thing.
Old timey mic, sound.
Very alt rocky, like 100%. 90s alt rock sound. Oh, yeah,
right
totally.
There with it. Right.
But then like they go into this like extended, prolonged, like noodling section almost,
and it's hilarious.
It's crazy. And like what I was thinking about is like I think the reason my initial reception of this album was kind of poor is because the sound of the mix of it in particular is very strange to me. Like if you listen to the drums throughout the album, like they're clean, like it's totally clean, like the entire album, and like they are using Mellotrons, they have like that distorted like phone filter sound with the vocals, the guitar is like distorted, and I'd assume they have effects on like the bass and a lot of the other stuff too, and yet they leave the drums like purposefully extremely clean throughout the entire album.
And to me, that makes sense, actually, because if you look at the 1960s, the Nutcell, you got Mellotron, you've got phone filters, you've got a couple of these other things going on, but the drums are always left clean.
It definitely is characteristic for the time period.
Right.
Yeah, totally. Because I know they definitely do dabble in some, like, interesting drum machine sounds and stuff later on, so they're never, like, behind on technology and stuff like that, but I definitely did find it a bit interesting because I, like, for example, on I Talk to the Wind, I think it fits so perfect. Like, the clean drums kind of complement that, like, that flute that's just waning in the back of your head, sort of. Right. Like, it's almost like the wind. I heard somebody compare that song. Like, the lyrics are, like, calling out, and then the flute is responding. And so, like, in a sense, they're talking to the wind as if, like, the flute is the wind.
And I feel like the drums, like you said, support that so well. I mean, the clean chops, I feel like they reflect... I mean, that whole song, the sound, the overall, like, timbre of the entire track resembles pretty much any pop that you've heard over the past 50
years, totally.
You know?
Yeah, that song always sticks out to me in particular with that album. I think it's mastered perfectly. Like, I think that's exactly how I would want it to sound. What was your initial, like, reception of the album?
Like, the first time I heard it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was definitely bad at first.
Oh,
and
really?
And, like, all of my favorite genres, I mean, anyone who knows me knows that I'm a big rock and roll, big heavy metal, big jazz and ska lover, and maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I hated the genre. I thought it was brash and harsh, and I did not understand the sound, and every single genre or album that I've ever come to love, grown to love, my first listen was like, this is terrible, this is junk. And then my 100th listen is like, this is the greatest thing ever.
Yep, it grows on you a lot,
and
for
King
sure.
Crimson is the same. I mean, it was definitely a gateway drug. It was definitely a threshold, and I just kept going back to it unknowingly, and I started pushing the threshold, and now it's a staple.
Okay, we have to take a little break here, but we'll be right back with more Crimson.
My name is Tris Parrish.
My name is Mason Chase Martin.
My name is Brian Brown.
When I complete my degree, I want to combine interview podcasting with fictional animation.
I want to become a music composer.
I want to be a video editor.
My name is Tris Parrish.
My name is Brian.
My name is Mason Chase Martin.
And I am ComArtsSci.
Start your journey at comartsci.msu.edu.
I'm back with a cool Lingam Poly, and we are talking about King Crimson.
Why don't we move forward a little bit to your more recent listens, now that you've, like, certainly heard it a bit more, and, like, you've had a lot of time to kind of gestate with the sound. Is there anything that, like, jumped out to you more recently that didn't necessarily jump out to you when you initially listened to it?
That's a really good question. Well, my most recent listen was actually when you reached out
and,
you know, told me about this whole thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to start listening to it. And I sat down in my living room, and I have kind of curated this, like, 1990s Kenwood surround sound stereo system in my living room just from old speakers that people have given me. It sounds fantastic. I sat down, I hit play, and I listened the whole thing through. Just sat there with, like, a bowl of cereal and listened the whole thing through. And the first thing that popped out to me was how crisp the mix was. I mean, it wasn't punchy, like, and this could do with the EQ that I have set, this could do with the speaker system and the amps I was using, but sitting there in that room, everything was so punctual and on the dot in the sound. I mean, the drums weren't booming out to me through the subwoofer. They were, like, punching through and just, like, poking me.
See, that's really interesting to me. I was actually wondering about this because given that the album came out in 69, they certainly never, like, thought of it as being consumed through, like, that kind of a system. And so I was going to ask, do you think there's a certain way that you feel it should be consumed?
Question. So just as a disclaimer, the version I was listening to was the expanded and remastered original album mix on Spotify Premium, which has been remastered.
Yeah.
And I believe the remaster, which is the only one I really have experience with, fits modern consumption, like digital compressed audio, really well. But being a vinyl lover and a vinyl understanding, you know, what the value in a $600 turntable is, I think the only way to truly experience it is just to play it on vinyl and hear it through a good quality needle and a good quality preamp and just some old bookshelf speakers. And I think that's the way to do it.
I would, I'm a little biased, but I generally agree with that. Yeah. That's good to hear because I definitely have been consuming most of my music recently through headphones. And when I think of the mix, a lot of the time I think of what it sounds like to me in the headphones through like Spotify. And I think a lot of the weirdness to me in the mix comes from that. But I know, like, if you were to consume it through, like, a speaker system, it'd sound very different. Right. So that's interesting. I'm glad that it, like, you really enjoyed how the mix sounded like that. Do you think there's any reasons besides nostalgia to revisit this album?
Absolutely. I mean, a great example would be I was listening to the album in my living room, and my roommate walked by, and he... is still exploring rock music. I mean, he's in the Nirvana, Green Day, kind of like early entry to rock phase. And he walked by and he was like, wow, I've never heard anything like that. That's so fascinating. And I'm like, exactly. I learn something new every time I listen to it. And as a musician, as a drummer, it's so valuable. It's the benchmark for where I want to be someday. And even just from a normal non-musician, just someone who enjoys listening music, it makes you aware of where your favorite sounds came from.
Totally. Yeah, I completely agree. And that's a really good goal to be setting too. Like,
right, exactly.
The Crimson Cats are definitely some of the
top dogs there.
Top-notch musicians.
Right.
Okay, and so on a pretty similar note, after listening to it again after all these years and kind of taking a lot of time to really take it in, do you think that nowadays it still holds up as an album?
Absolutely. I think it's one of the albums that holds up the best. I mean, it's such a relevant piece of media. I don't think the popularity or the notoriety that it has gone anywhere. I mean, it's a work of art, and it absolutely holds up.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an awesome time talking with you, and let's listen to some Crimson.
Thank you for having me here, and I had a blast. Thank you.
Yeah, dude. Awesome. Sweet.
Find the Classic Holdup on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us at Audio Video Land for updates, teasers, and behind-the-scenes content of all Audio Video Land productions. The Classic Holdup is an Audio Video Land production by digital storytelling students of Michigan State University in collaboration with Impact 89 FM.